Good evening. My name is Peter Fleisch. I'm the Grateful Alcoholic. I think I want to thank Kelly for asking me to speak tonight. When he called, I suggested several other names, and he said, no, it's your turn in the barrel. So here I am. It's nice to be here, safe, sane, and sober, and that wasn't always the case. And this is a very special meeting for me. There are two meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous that I go to on a somewhat regular basis that I never wanted to talk at, and this was one of them. The other one's a very large group that held on Wednesday night up in Los Angeles, and I hope I can duck that for many, many years. But the reason this group is so special, because it is one of those pockets of enthusiasm that you don't rarely see in Alcoholics Anonymous today. You can walk into this meeting absolutely new or from another area, and instantly you're felt made to feel warm and welcome and loved, and that's because of what goes on in this group. And I have been here when my sponsor has spoken, and his sponsor, and his sponsor. And I always liked sitting there listening to them, and I was always praying it was never going to be my turn. And the gentleman who started this group has a dear place in my heart. And the men who and women are in this group that I have seen around AA for a long time have carried the message to me when I was brand new. As a matter of fact, there's some people, a gentleman who took a cake tonight, watched me come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's great, but it changes my story somewhat. I'm going to have to tell the truth, and I didn't want to do that. I wore a jacket and tie here, and it's warm, and I'm taking care of that. Hey, I subscribe to a blue book that's over there, and it's called the Basic Text of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is in there. I found my story in my life, and I follow its guidelines specifically, and it says to share what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now, and the we we're going to talk about tonight is me, because that's the only story I can tell you. My story is the same since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that could change is sobriety, and I choose not to go back out to change my story. I'd like to tell you Harry's story tonight. I've heard it so many times. It seems every time I go out of town, and there's Harry, and he's speaking, and I said, no, Harry, you missed that part. I remember that one. Changes it a little bit now and again. Throws me off. I would like to tell you that I come from a terrible, terrible alcoholic family. It's not true. You know, I'm an adult child of a functional family. There's a rare commodity in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I never saw my father take a drink, and I've never seen my mother drunk. I am an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I drank alcohol. I have absolutely no one to blame but myself. I suffer from a disease that is mentioned in that book, and it seems that I have an obsession of the mind and, you know, an abnormal body reaction to alcohol. I didn't know that. I didn't know much at all until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what you're going to get is absolutely my opinion and my story as it has been revealed to me while I have been here. I didn't know anything when I walked in these rooms, and fortunately they were kind enough to let me stay and develop, and today I know a little bit about where I came from and perhaps a little bit of where I am, and I'm taking your strength and going on from there. I was born in a very small little town. It's called New York City. And a section of that town is called Harlem. And I can tell you all my life I felt different. Walking around that town, I can tell you, you feel different. And my parents did the very best they could. They came here from another country, oppressed from a concentration camp, and they were grateful to be alive and in this country. And I can tell you from my earliest memories, I am restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't like a goddamn thing that's going on. I don't like doing this either. But I know that no one ever died from speaking, and naturally, some of them got, I was going to say stoned, but that's inappropriate today. It's a couple that can relate out here. I can tell you my first drink, because It has been told to me. I'm what's known as a blackout drinker. I'm also a blackout speaker. About 3 minutes from now, I won't know a thing of what I said. God has a merciful way of being kind to people like me. And my first drink was I was 2.5 years old, and this was a story that was told to me time and time again, and I guess it was significant. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic. I don't get into that controversy, you know, your genetic makeup and whatnot, but I know when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I was 2.5 years old. And we were at a Christmas party at a friend's house down the street, and they thought it would be cute to give the kids some eggnog, and my friend took a drink, and I took a drink, and he's one of those normal people that I never understood my whole life. He took a sip of it and kind of went, yeah. And I took a sip of mine and went, And then I took a sip of his. And then I ran around taking sips of everybody else I get my hands on, and the behavior automatically became inappropriate for the group that was around there, and they said, well, why don't we put him and his little friend in the parents' bedroom? So I said, okay, what do I know? And they gave us a ball, and we were playing ball, and well, the ball rolled under the bed, and we couldn't find it. Well, it occurred to me with a couple of drinks that back then they had Christmas trees and lit candles on them, that if I just took one of those candles and looked under the bed, I could see the ball. Well, I did that, and I saw the ball. But the bed went on fire. And then the drapes went on fire. And then the house burned down. And that was my first drink. I wasted no time trying to get membership into this program. And I didn't do really well after that. You know, it's funny. I was here not too long ago, and Harry was talking, and I can remember very vividly a part in my life that I was going to take to the grave with me, and I shared it with only one other human being. I'd never heard anybody share it from the podium before. That during that course of going to school, I was left back in kindergarten, and it was a terrible stigma to me somewhere along the way. How do you get left back in kindergarten? I mean, failed finger painting or, you know, blocks or something? I don't know. But they said that I didn't emotionally adjust to the other children. And I never emotionally adjusted to anybody. And I didn't know that, and it took me quite some time for me to even understand that. And I had a real difficult time in school, extremely difficult time. And what transpired is that they decided to give me some of those tests that they give kids, and the teacher was, her name was Mrs. Orens, a dear woman. She was my third grade teacher. And I'm sure she's dead now. I hope she's dead now. She was a very, wait a minute now, you think I'm insensitive. She was a very old woman back then. This was a long time ago. And they took those tests with me, and they said that I had some aptitude, that I should be able to pass these classes and spell and things of that nature, and I just couldn't do it. They gave me a label that was to stick with me for a long time, the rest of my life. You know, Peter has such wonderful potential if he'd only apply himself. And they would say, why don't you do this? And I would say, I don't want to. Well, you have to. Why? You know, that was always me. Why? Why do I have to do this? I don't want to do that. I liked the streets. That's the place that was comfortable for me. I liked the action out there. I liked what was going on. I liked the older people. I liked the con games. I liked all that stuff that I learned out on the streets. And I didn't like this lifestyle. I mean, I came from a nice home, and the minute I had an opportunity, I wanted out. I wanted to hang out even young, I mean 5, 6 years old, looking under the swinging doors of the bar. I like those places. I am a bar drinker by nature. I love those places. For a long time, that was home for me. I didn't know that years would come that a room like this would become home to me, because the same people were there are here. They just do some of the things a little differently. And I would try to fit in, and I just couldn't do it. You know, and I can tell you today that I understand that different people don't know that they're different. And that's what I had. I had the disease of alcoholism for a long time. And I didn't know it, and no one ever pointed it out to me. Matter of fact, I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous till 1972 in my very first meeting. And it was, of course, was in a penitentiary. But that's another story, and we'll get to that a little later. Well, I I learned something in the streets that was very valuable and would stay with me for the rest of my life. We read it every meeting. It says, if you want what we have. My job in the streets was to find out what you wanted so I could acquire it, so you could get it, so you would like me, so I could sell it and I could make a profit. I used to call myself a commodities broker. The criminal justice system called me a drug dealer. I always thought that was very unfair. But I went about doing that, and that's what I did for a long time. And so as a direct result of that kind of lifestyle, and I don't want to stay drunk for terribly long, I've been in jails, prisons, and institutions for pretty much a third of my life. I have been in prison for 11 times for 11 years. I kind of like those numbers. And I never understood that. And I would move a lot, and I would try things, and I would be out there ripping and tearing, and they would ask me to do things in society that I just could not understand. They say things like, why don't you get a job? Oh, okay, I'll get a job. And then I go to work, and then the guy says, okay, you came today at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I do the job, and he says, okay, you come back tomorrow. Again? What time? 8 o'clock. Why? Because that's what we do here. We do the same job every day at every time. I said, that's ridiculous. I want to do it one day, and then I want to do something the next day, and I want to become the vice president of General Motors in 2 weeks. And they said, it doesn't work that way. And I said, well, screw you. I'm going to go out and do what I do. And so I go out and do the business that I know best. And they weren't very successful years. But I acquired things, and that was the measurement of my life, stuff. The acquisition of things that were important. My sponsor, Barney, talks about stuff with reverence, and the natural acquisition is the guy who has the most stuff when he dies wins. And I went out trying to acquire that, and periodically they would kind of take it away from me. And then I would go out and do it again and do it again. And I understand in Alcoholics Anonymous the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again expecting a different result. And that's what I did, over and over and over again. I can tell you a time that I was in Rahway State Penitentiary and it was getting out in 1972 after I'd just done 3 years. And I don't know about you, but it got to the point where I was no longer just like social drinker. I don't really know what a social drinker is. Perhaps the best definition I've ever heard of a social drinker as opposed to an alcoholic. You can see them at any party. You just watch them. The social drinker's walking around going, do you know where my wine is? I seem to have lost my glass. The alcoholic shaking his head and says, listen, baby, I know where your wine is. I know where my wine is. I know where they all came from, And so I had just gotten out, and they give you that suit of clothes, and they give you the shoes that you wear, and some people here identify with that and a few dollars, and they conveniently place a bar about a quarter mile down the road from the main gate. And I needed a drink. I mean, it wasn't a matter of I wanted. I needed a drink real bad, and I walked in there, and they knew me. They knew exactly who I was. They knew where I'd come from, and they said, need a drink, huh, kid? And they poured me a drink, and I drank just the way I left off before I went there, and that $20 didn't last very long, and all of a sudden some guy comes up to me and says, out of money, huh? I said, yeah. He says, you want a drink? I said, yeah. He says, well, I know this little liquor store we can knock off. Now, see, a normal person would have said, excuse me, I just kind of spent 3 years visiting this place, and they do very nasty things to you in there, and it's not a nice place. I have learned my lesson, and I don't want to do that. But see, I'm under the lash of alcohol, and I said, absolutely. And 8 hours later, I was back in the same joint. And that was my pattern, to do it over and over and over again. And I moved a lot. My motto was, when the heat's on, put your rags in your bags, let your feet hit the street. I didn't know they were geographics until I read that book. And I tried every possible combination that they say in Chapter 3 except not taking a trip. I tried all of it. I moved places, and I tried different people. And my answer was that if I just had that, I would be okay. It was the same philosophy that I used drinking. I said, if I ever got that bad, I'll stop. No, I mean that bad. No, I mean that bad. And the same thing when I was doing okay. If I ever get here, I'll be all right. If I just had a house, if I just had a car, if I just had a job, if I just had a place to stay. Well, I mean, I'm talking about a better house. I'm talking about a better car. And I don't want to be with that woman. I want to be with that woman. And I would try all those combinations, and that was my irritability and my discontent consistently. And so I tried marriage. I tried that 3 times. And that didn't work out. You know, none of those women ever really understood me. Second one is still a little resentful. I went out for a pack of cigarettes and never came back. Just split, you know. And I don't know why, but on wife number 3, I figured I'd start a whole new clean slate. I picked out a really sweet woman, and she wasn't an alcoholic, and she was an aspiring psychologist. An alcoholic married to a psychologist is a very interesting combination. We moved out to California, and after our marriage, I remember my wedding, I was so drunk, so loaded, that the guy had asked me 3 times if I was going to marry this woman, and I was just too drunk to talk. And this guy behind me grabbed the back of my hair and just nodded. I said, no. That's how I got married, you know. And 5 minutes later, I was taking off all my clothes in the middle of the reception. And people left, and I just didn't understand why they were so, you know, they just didn't understand me. My behavior had never been appropriate. When we came out to California with things that matched, a big U-Haul truck, you know, matching furniture, glasses that looked the same, and we moved into a condo in Mission Valley. And I'd been to California before, but I'd never been in a condo. I didn't even know what it was. I kind of thought if you left it in your wallet for a long time, you left a ring in it. And she went off to school and to work, and then I went to the place that I know. I went to the jacuzzi. And she would ask me questions like, are you going to get a job? And I would say, soon. Real soon. She would say, when? I said, tomorrow. I'm going to do it tomorrow. And while that time was going on, I went back into the business that I know best. You know, my MO is very simple. You know, if I have a scale and I go to a bar, I'm in business. And that's just real simple. And I just started going back to the same business that I had always been in before and figuring that this time it was going to be different. I wasn't going to use any of that stuff. Well, as you can see, that I'm telling you that I'm an alcoholic, and part of my story is that I have used every chemical that I know mankind has made up, except a couple since I've been sober, and I don't choose to try them today. But I'm just an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic and anything. And I'm going to explain to you, if you are new, why I am just an alcoholic. When I came into these rooms, initially I was a drug addict and an alcoholic, maybe. The guy who was taking me to these meetings was an alcoholic, so I was just kind of doing it for his benefit. And it occurred to me that I was different than everybody else in the one place that I can no longer afford to be different. And so I modified my story, and I was a alcoholic and a drug addict. And that didn't work either. And then I became an alcoholic, and all of a sudden I felt that I belonged in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I found out that I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. I'll use anything that I can to get me to a place that I don't want to be. I don't like reality. So I'm just an alcoholic. I don't want to be different than you anymore. I want to be the same. I want to be part of, and I want to be part of this group and a part of this fellowship. And for me, the way I needed to do that was just to be an alcoholic and let all that other stuff go away. But back to going to the business that I was in, I started to run into some problems like we normally run into. I was having some car problems. I used to hit things. Things that moved, things that didn't move. Jim is laughing because he is a good friend of my very first sponsor, and he was my insurance agent. And I would go to him with these incredible stories about, you know, how this tree jumped out and hit me. You know, or one time I'm driving and these lights came on behind me and I knew it was them. You know them, they're coming after me. And I had all this stuff on me and I'm sticking it in my body and drinking like a madman, and I'm waiting and waiting and waiting, and the lights are getting closer and it's taking forever. And I sit there for about 15 minutes and the street sweeper came out and passed me, and I was terribly embarrassed, and I couldn't drive home anymore. I was just too loaded. And I'd go out of those bars, and I'd close those bars, and after the bars, I'd bring them all home with me, because I had in my pocket what you wanted, and you would follow me. And then I would have some problems along the way on getting home. One night, I just bought a brand new car. I remembered real vividly. I was out someplace, and somebody didn't like the car I was driving, so I bought a new one real quick, and I drove it to this bar in Mission Valley, and it has a very steep hill, and I jumped in, and I said, two drinks. I always had two drinks, one for each hand, because if I didn't have a drink in each hand, I'd start to shake a little. And I start drinking the way I normally drink, and somebody runs in and says, "My God, this brand new car just rolled down the hill and smashed into 11 cars. And I looked at him and said, "Gee, that's too bad." And then he explained what car it was, and I said, "I really feel sorry for the guy, because I just bought one of those." Well, let me go take a look. So I walked out properly armed, drink in each hand, and I looked around. My car wasn't where it was supposed to be. And then I looked down the bottom of the hill. There's a lot of people very pissed off. I went back in the bar, and I, called the cab and called up my insurance agent and said, "Well, car was stolen, and I don't know what happened." And that's what I do all the time. And he would say, "I understand. It's going to cost you more money." And I said, "No problem." And alcohol was no longer working for me, and I didn't know it. But I kept on this procession, and I had to leave the wife, and because she was just nagging on me, and then I had a girlfriend, and I had to leave her, and I I found a mistress, and I was trying to find the lower companionship that I was seeking, and I found them. I always found them. And it got kind of bad, and the business that I was in, I got to tell you in all sincerity, that life started to become very cheap, my life especially and yours particularly. And there was a time that I was out in Palm Springs, and I got to speak in Palm Springs next week. And we were in a place, and we had just finished one of our little business ventures, and we had a pile of this and a pile of that, and we were playing cards, and I bet a sum of money, and the guy looked at me and says, "Well, you have it or you don't." And I said, "Well, that's poker. Bet and find out." He said, "Well, do you have it or you don't, you cheap and so-and-so?" And I said, "Well, bet you slimy so-and-so and find out." He looked at me and says, "You cheap Jew bastard, do you have it or you don't?" And I just reached into my pocket and went, I remember when I shot him. Slammed up against the wall and blood spurting everywhere. And I remember the look in his eyes. And I can tell you what I felt. Nothing. And I looked over the next guy and said, "He's out. It's your bed." And we proceeded to play cards a little longer. And I just left him there. Took his money and took his drugs and said, "Well, screw him." And that's the kind of person that I became. I didn't mean to. I can remember a freckle-faced little curly-haired boy back in New York, it didn't want to do that. Well, unfortunately, in the business that I'm in, one day came again, and that was April 18th, 1984, and I walked out of a bar after a deal had been consummated, and this guy came up to me with his long trench coat on, and I thought he was an alcoholic, and I was ready to give him some money, and he pulled back his coat, and he shoved the shotgun down my throat and said, "DEA," and I went, "Oh, here we go again." See, but I no longer wanted to live, so I just kicked at him and cursed at him and begged him to blow my brains out, and he wouldn't do it. I thought that was the worst day of my life, and he took me to jail, and they took all my stuff away again. And I managed to get on jail and on bail, and I don't know about you, but they took everything away, and all the people that I associated with ran away from me, and I was there left alone naked in the world. And I don't know about you, but the only thing I need to do with them is I have to have a drink. I got to have a drink real bad. I did the thing that I was probably most ashamed of. It was April 20th, 1984, and I broke into my best friend's house and stole his daughter's piggy bank and went for one drink. I came to May 17th, 1984, and I was living downtown in a dumpster. I have found out that I had been down to all the detoxes and been thrown out of there, and that my blood was substandard, and I was less than an animal, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to turn. I had that moment of clarity that I cannot explain, and I hope everybody has it here. If you're new, I hope to God you have one of those. And I walked from downtown to Claremont Mesa Boulevard in 163. You don't get a ride when you look the way I looked. I was 123, 130 pounds, open sores, and a mess. And I walked to that insurance agent to tell him that I couldn't make the payments on the cars. I don't know why, I just had to go see him. And he asked me to come in, and he said, "What's the problem?" I said, "I have a problem with drugs." He said, "What?" I said, "I have a problem with drugs." "What?" "Speak loudly and slowly." I said, "I have a problem with drugs and alcohol." See, I'd been to my first AA meeting in 1972, as I told you, in Rahway State Penitentiary, and I never went back. It was 12 tough years between then and 84, and he said, "Oh, welcome. reached his hand across the desk and says, "My name is Paul S. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I have been waiting for you for 6.5 years. I went, "No." He said, "Yep, now we got to get busy." I said, "What do you mean busy?" He says, "We got to go to AA meetings." "Oh, no, 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 no. I'm not going to no AA meetings. I've never been to one outside of prison, but I know what they are. They're held in a burnt-out church basement with bare light bulbs and 80-year-old men with raincoats going, 'Life is over.'" And I said, "No way, baby." He says, "Yeah, we're going to an AA meeting." And I didn't go the first day because I went to another 12-step program, and I went loaded, and some guy said, "I'll miss some of the old days. I'll miss driving with one hand on the mirror, the other hand on the straw, and my knee steering the car." And that's exactly what I did on the way to that meeting. And I figured he was, like, filming me so it could be on at 11. I wasn't too paranoid when I got here. And I went and called him the next day and said, I'll try that AA meeting, and we went to Rancho Santa Fe, California. I mean, they have Rolls Royces in the goddamn parking lot. And I walked in, and they read that portion of Chapter 5, "If you want what we have." I looked around the room and said, "You bet." And this little lady with, like, more gold on than I can imagine, she stood up and said, "You know, would you like to share?" "Yeah. I want to know when you're not home so I can rip you off. I want to rape your wives and molest your daughters." And I sat down. She said, "Oh, you just keep coming back, honey." So I did. I will tell you today that I'm the treasurer of that meeting. But that woman who told me to keep coming back had a burglar alarm installed in her house. She told me on my third birthday of sobriety, and then she invited me for Christmas dinner. Things change here in AA. Well, I still had this criminal matter ahead of me, and I had some problems. I had some real problems, and I wasn't going to stay here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with the worst attitude in the world, and if you're new tonight and you got a shitty attitude, welcome, because I have that when I got here, and I have it often when I'm here today. And I need to make amends a lot for the wreckage of the present, not only the past. And they said, "You got to start working these steps," and I said, I can't do that. And I really got stuck on step 3. You know, they talked about, you know, turning your will and your life over to God, you know, and they hold the hands here and they say the Lord's Prayer. And that's very nice, but when you're Jewish like I am, you don't know that one. And you can't ask anybody because you're too arrogant like I am. And so it takes a long time writing a prayer down one word at a time and trying to remember it until you finally get it, because I didn't think if I knew it I could stay here. And they talked about it, and finally somebody stood up and talked about the difference between spirituality and religion. And I was very confused with that. I didn't have a religious background. I didn't have a spiritual background. I didn't know what the hell you were talking about. And a guy stood up and finally told a story that I love, and I tell this story a lot, and it's the difference between spirituality and religion. It's if you're like me, maybe this will help. The story of a man who dies, and he's a very spiritual man, and he goes to the gates of heaven. And he's met there by, well, for the lack of anything better, my cousin, St. Peter. And Peter says, "I'm here." And Peter says, "Yep, you're on the list." He says, "Where do I go?" I says, "Well, I can't tell you that. I can show you. You pick where you want to go." And takes him to the first door, and a whole bunch of people in hardback, straight pews, wearing starched shirts and collars, and they're squinting at this little book. And he says, No. I this isn't it. I can't stay here. Who are these people?" He says, "Well, these are the Protestants, and they think this is joy." He says, "You have anything else?" He says, "Yep." Takes him to another door and opens up. There's a whole bunch of people on their knees playing with these beads as fast as they can. He says, "This is worse than the last group. But who are they?" He says, "Well, these are the Catholics, and we can't seem to explain to them that they've already made it." He says, "You got anything else?" And yep, he starts taking him through a series of doors. And one door, there's a bunch of people with little beanies on their head reading the scroll from left to right. He says, "No way, you got anything else?" And he tries another one, and they're on their knees facing the east in a language he doesn't understand. And he shows him a whole bunch of doors, and finally, exasperated, he says, "Do you have anything else?" He says, "Yeah, we have this one." And he goes, opens the door, and the first thing he notices is the smell of fresh brewed coffee. Clouds of stale cigarette smell come billowing out the door. kind of peers in. He sees people laughing and hugging and scratching and talking dirty and having a good time. He says, now, I think I could spend the rest of eternity with these people, but curiously, who are they? St. Peter scratches his head and says, we don't know. And they won't tell us. But we're letting them stay because they're only staying a day at a time. And my grant sponsor, Johnny H., says all the time, and it finally clicked one day, that I am sober today through the grace of a loving God as he expresses himself through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went, whoa! This is a spiritual program! And somebody looked at me and said, where the hell have you been? I said, I had no idea. I said that the things that are done here in Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual in nature. And that my disease was spiritual in nature, that did not leave me the eyes to see, the ears to hear, or a heart to feel. And I was blown away. And I was very fortunate that I have people in my life who said that, Peter, action is the magic word here at Alcoholics Anonymous. What goes on in this room? People like Harry and Jim and, and God, I can just keep going on, Bobby and Marianne and so many friends in this room. And they say, action, action, action. And I said, what do you mean action? Set up a chair. And I said, I can't go to those meetings. I just feel uncomfortable. He says, well, you go early and you set up a chair first. Be the first person in that room and let everybody grow up around you. And then you're not alone. Because if you walk into a full room, you'll never make it. So I had to do that. And I had to follow these dumb directions that made no sense to me at all. And they worked magic. Only in retrospect do I know that today. And I started working these steps, and they talked about amends. And I said, I have a hell of a wreckage. And I made a list of all those things, and I shared it with somebody. And I threw up several times as I was sharing it with him. And he kind of nodded while I was reading it to him, because it was like no big deal to him. But it was a real big deal to me. And after I'd done it, I found out it was really no big deal. And he said, all you have to do is become willing, and you start that process. And I stood in front of that judge at a little over a year of sobriety, and I was living in a recovery home, and men who lived with me had died. And I found out the terrible nature of the disease of alcoholism. Sober people die because they think they can come back in these rooms, and I found out that you can't. That a lot of people say the door swings both ways, and I have buried more people than I've seen get married here. And I have not been sober that long, and I know that this disease didn't kill, I wouldn't be working my ass off to stay here. I stood in front of that judge, and the prosecutor said, Your Honor, in our opinion, Peter Fleischman is constitutionally incapable of being a useful member of society. In our opinion, he should be incarcerated in a federal institution for the rest of his natural life. And the judge says to me, what do you have to say for yourself? And I said, that's right, Your Honor. That's the epitaph that I wrote with drugs and alcohol. And it's going to take me the rest of my life to make amends, and I'll do whatever you tell me to do. He says, well, would you come back later? I got to go to a funeral. And we came back that afternoon. I was going to go get drunk, and my sponsor says, no, we're going to go have iced tea. And we stood in front of that judge, and he didn't send me to jail, and I don't know why. I don't know why. I didn't do that. I didn't have the eyes to see, the ears to hear, heart to feel, but Alcoholics Anonymous, a God that I didn't even understand working in my life. And they said, you have to go to AA meetings. And for a while, I thought that was a good idea, but I said, Jesus, that's not me. I don't do anything consistently. I said, well, just get involved. And I did get involved. And I sponsored some men. And I mean, the guys I sponsored just saved my life. They're the most wonderful things in the world. I mean, they are so sick and so nuts. And I get to listen to them for a while, and they go, and then I get to relate to me. I mean, if you don't think Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual nature, there's a gentleman sitting in the first row. His name is Sam. And he thinks I'm picking on him. But where else, he uses this line, I'm going to steal it from him, where else can a Iranian Marxist-Leninist Muslim be sponsored by a Jew? He talks about the God of his understanding, and I don't understand it, but if it works for him, that's good. And I have one of those sponsors who says, Peter, I don't care how you feel, and I don't care what you're thinking. I care how your feet are moving and what actions you are taking. I have been blessed to be involved in certain things. I remember my first year of sobriety, I was involved in the San Diego Spring Roundup. And some people are laughing because they gave me a job. They didn't know what to do with me, so they let me hold all the money. I'm just recently out on parole, and they gave me all the cash of the roundup, and I gave it all back to them, including the $3 or $6 that I owned. You know, and that was an honor and a privilege, as it is to speak in this meeting, as it is to participate in any form in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be sober. You know, this coming year in that San Diego Spring Roundup, I am the co-chairman of the whole thing, and next year I'll be the chairman. You know, I can tell you some of the miracles, and one of the miracles, because my time runs short here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I stood, three, 4 years now, at the Town and Country Hotel at one of the Southern California conventions, and I was feeling pretty lonely and forlorn, and, you know, I had the stupid AA badge on, and I'm, you know, I'm basically just a pathetic mess, drooling, and all these people are having fun, and I don't know how to do that yet. And all of a sudden I look across the lobby, and there was the guy that I shot in Palm Springs. My head said he found me. And all I have is this dumb AA badge. He sees me and starts walking across the room. And, I mean, something starts oozing down my leg. And I can't look him in the eye. I can just look at his hands. And I know I'm going to die right there on the spot. He puts his arms around me and he starts crying. And he says, "Can you ever forgive me?" I can't do that. Alcoholics Anonymous does that. God, as he expresses himself through this program, does that. Today he has something I want. We're good friends today. He's 18 months sober, longer than I am, and he's a sobriety buddy. People like me don't get these kind of benefits. They really don't. You know, it does not matter where you come from. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter. This is an equal opportunity disease, and Alcoholics Anonymous is the way it was designed by the old-timers. I like that gentleman who took a 22-year kick. You know, they don't care. This is sobriety here, and love, and a fellowship. You know, I'm out of time, and you have some questions and answers, and I'm going to end as I normally do, and I want to thank those for being here, for letting me participate in my sobriety, and I'm going to leave you with three prayers that they left me. You know, if you're new, and I consider myself new all the time, and welcome, I hope you stay. I hope you keep coming back and you listen to the music. Music, it's the love and the laughter, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Stay here long enough and one day you'll understand the words and be able to sing. The second prayer, if you're new, I pray to God that you keep coming back, and it's okay. Put your hand in ours. Not mine, ours. We know the way, but don't ever let go. If you let go, we might lose you, and we don't want to lose anybody if we can help it. And the third prayer, which is the hardest one for me, and I hope it's not that difficult for you. If you're new, I hope to God that you keep coming back. Keep coming back and keep coming back and let us love you. And over and over and over until you learn to love yourself. I love you a lot. Thank you very much for having me.